brother for some time. Frank had intended to come east that winter, but work on the ranch forced a postponement. Early in February 1954, the two brothers talked on the phone, and Robert revealed that he was in considerable trouble. He hoped they could meet soon, he said, because since returning from Europe he had tried, but was unable, to compose a letter that would adequately discuss his problem. To his friends, Robert seemed distracted and inexplicably passive. One day, while listening to the lawyers talk about legal strategy, Verna Hobson lost her patience and began to push Robert. "I thought Robert was not fighting hard enough," she recalled. "I thought Lloyd Garrison was being too gentlemanly. I was angry. I thought we should go out and fight." Hobson was often privy to the lawyers' discussions, and as far as she could determine, they were not helping their client. "It seemed to me that the whole story was such an obvious piece of nonsense," she said. "Robert's critics in Washington were not open to sweet reason, and whoever was doing this must be using it as a tool, and the thing to do was push back, kick back, attack." Hobson was too scared to say what she thought before the whole group of lawyers, "but I kept muttering it at him." Finally, Oppenheimer took her aside, and, as they stood on the back steps of Olden Manor, he said very gently, "Verna, I really am fighting just as hard as I know how, and what seems to me to be the best way." Hobson was not the only one who thought Garrison was not aggressive enough. Kitty, too, was unhappy with the direction the legal team was taking her husband. Kitty was a fighter. 20 years had passed since, as a young woman, she had stood outside factory gates in Youngstown, Ohio, passing out communist literature. Now, perhaps for the first time since, this ordeal would require all her energy, tenacity, and intelligence. Her past life, after all, was part of the indictment against her husband. She, too, would probably have to testify. It would be an ordeal for her as well as for him. One Saturday at midday, after working all morning on his reply to the AEC charges, Oppenheimer emerged from his office accompanied by Hobson. "I was going to drive him to his house," Hobson recalled. But as they walked out to the parking lot, Einstein suddenly appeared and Oppenheimer stopped to chat with him. Hobson sat in the car while the two men talked, and when Oppie returned to the car, he told her, "Einstein thinks that the attack on me is so outrageous that I should just resign." Perhaps recalling his own experience in Nazi Germany, Einstein argued that Oppenheimer had no obligation to subject himself to the witch hunt, that he had served his country well, and if this was the reward that America offered, he should turn his back on her. Hobson vividly remembered Oppenheimer's reaction. "Einstein doesn't understand." Einstein had fled his homeland as it was about to be overwhelmed by the Nazi contagion, and he refused ever again to set foot in Germany. But Oppenheimer could not turn his back on America. "He loved America," Hobson later insisted, "and this love was as deep as his love of science." Einstein walked to his office in Fould Hall, and nodding in Oppenheimer's direction, told his assistant, "There goes a narr. Fool." Einstein, of course, didn't think America was Nazi Germany, and he didn't believe Oppenheimer needed to flee. But he was truly alarmed by McCarthyism. In early 1951, he wrote his friend Queen Elizabeth of Belgium that here in America, "the German calamity of years ago repeats itself. People acquiesce without resistance and align themselves with the forces of evil." He now feared that by cooperating with the Government Security Board, Oppenheimer would not only humiliate himself, but would lend legitimacy to the whole poisonous process. Einstein's instincts were right, and time would demonstrate that Oppenheimer's were wrong. "Oppenheimer is not a gypsy like me," Einstein confided to his close friend Johanna Fantova. "I was born with the skin of an elephant. There is no one who can hurt me." Oppenheimer, he thought, clearly was a man who was easily hurt and intimidated.